Accession number 29077, Reel 3.
Herbert Bryce, Reel 3. How well were the vehicles you were using able to cope with the conditions?
Ah, that's a good point, that, actually, because we are trained on about 2.5, 3-ton Chevrolet vehicles, all the training for driver training, and we had to train them all, because basically they came straight from the jungle villages, and the majority of them had never seen a vehicle in their life before. Anyway, they were all trained, and they picked it up quite well. But when we got to Delhi to be given new vehicles, we were given a marvellous vehicles they were. They were Studebaker American vehicles, left-hand drive, cabs, very comfortable, all sealed up, four, six-wheel drive, and you could put tracks on the rears, so that they were absolutely first-class vehicles, given good conditions to work in. But when we got to Dimapur and found that we had just a single carriageway with re-entrance up and down mountains which were quite sharp, these vehicles were so big that you just couldn't negotiate them without reversing to get round. So although they were first-class vehicles and marvellous to drive in good conditions, and get you out of anywhere, in fact, with their six-wheel, you know, drive on each axle and each wheel, they weren't ideal for that particular road in the early stages, certainly not. But we got by, and they certainly were reliable, and they did a wonderful job, actually. In fact, I saw, when I went out there quite recently, I still saw one was still running. But they used those vehicles, lasted through most of the stages of the war, and at the end we got some big, heavier vehicles, and we were on the tank transporter and that type of vehicle, which one could cope with then, because the road had been widened. But we went, it was a pretty basic transport. It wasn't until perhaps after another 18 months or so that a Jeep showed its appearance, and that couldn't have been a better vehicle for the area. And once one had a Jeep, it was worth its weight in gold, actually. You could get anywhere with that. But as far as tanks were not really of any great help until one got down onto the Imphal plain and then onto the Burma plain. And so that they did use them at Kohima, but only one or two, and vital they were to their use, certainly was. But the fact that you had mountain on one side and steep drop on the other side, and a single there's nowhere a tank could go. It could be roadblocked and static, and so it was useless, really. And so vehicles, they were all right, provided you could keep them running.
Were supplies and spare parts a problem?
Well, supplies and spare parts for them were a bit short supply, actually, and the only way initially we could keep going was by when you frequently had a crash, and because of the type of road, you'd strip that vehicle and use those spares. That was the main source of supply. We did get certain spares coming in, but not really the quantity that we needed to cover the conditions under which we were working. So you made the best of what you had.
You mentioned the refugees. How much help was the army and the government giving to them?
It was the army entirely, actually, because the government didn't seem to have any. They were out of the picture. They were miles away. They didn't know what was happening, probably. But the army set up camps for the refugees and fed them. And it was and they would take them back to the railway and put them on the railway. And then the government, the Indian government, would take over once they were on the train. So. There must have been literally thousands of refugees who came out of Burma, and thousands that didn't make it or died on the way, and they all went eventually back to India, and I don't know what happened to them when they got into India. I don't know. The communications as to what was happening back in India were a bit sparse, quite frankly. We'd no newspapers, no radios, no nothing, no communications other than word of mouth that somebody that had been Indian had come in and tell you what was happening. So you really had no major line of communication. No doubt at the top level they would have done, but. Initially, it was quite a little Indian state, completely isolated, really. There was a Maharaja in charge of it, and he was still there. But then there was a district commissioner covering the particular areas. And he would be a white, a British-appointed district commissioner, as there was one at Kohima covering the people in that area called the Naga people, and who, again, were worth their weight in gold. And without them, I doubt that we would have held on at Kohima, quite frankly. They were not Indians as such. They were a completely different type of person, more Mongolian. They'd come down from the Tibetan side at some stage and from the mountains, and they were used to living in mountain areas, and their villages were all on the tops of the hills around the Kohima area. And they were tremendously fit people. They would have their cows and their sheep and their cattle in the valley, which would be 3,000 or 4,000 feet down, and the villages at the top, and they would go down and up every day and carry it all on their backs, that was their livelihood, really. They lived at the top and they worked at the bottom, and as they went along, they would chant, sing like hey ho. Hey ho, off for work we go, sort of thing. Not quite, but up to about I suppose it was the beginning of the 1900s. It was only 30 or 40 years before. They were literally headhunters, and they were in their villages. They would still have heads on a pole that you could see that they chant. But a Baptist missionary from America had gone into the area, they actually, over a period of time, they'd stopped their head hunting, and they developed, and he developed a very positive Christian community there, and so that when we got there, there was quite a strong Christian community. And when I went out there quite recently, last year, they. The population had grown tremendously, but all the Naga people, they classified themselves as Christian people, and so they didn't get on with the Indian people very well, and the Indian government didn't like them, because they want now, and we promised them this, and this was a sad thing, they never had promised them independence, Naga independence. When we handed over to the India took them over, and they've never given them independence because they want to keep that Assam area in India, you see, and the possibility of mineral rights and all this sort of thing. So sadly, the Nagas don't get on very well with the Indian government, and the Indian government have a substantial Indian army force there to keep them under control, and so they think. But they're a jolly crowd, very British law, and oddly enough, they their basic language and education, and which is now very good, is all done in English. They have a lot of little local dialects and which nobody understands. So they said, well, there's no point in printing all the school books in this. Do it in one. So they did it in English. And so we've at least left our mark there.
You had a good relationship with the local population.
Very, very good relationship indeed, yes. You couldn't have asked for more helpful, more cheerful, more loyal local population. And when the Japanese came in, the Japanese thought that they would they'd been looking a bit like Japanese, and they thought, oh, well, we'll get on well with them, but in fact they didn't. And the Nagas would come creep back and tell us what was happening, and we were jolly good spies. And then they wouldn't give the Japanese any food, and as the Japanese came in with very little food, then they started pinching it from them, and that didn't go down well with the Nagas either. So all in all, they've blotted their copybook with the Naga community, and luckily for us, they helped us out, and although they didn't actually do much fighting. There was one. I think there was a story that they obliterated one Japanese unit, and nobody knew what happened to them. But because they used to use not kukris like the Gurkhas used, but they used to have a sharp bladed knife, which was equally as powerful. And they would that was their like that and a stick. And because climbing up and down the hills, they needed a stick, but the knife would cut their way through jungle and cut their food up and give them a shave if necessary, and cut their hair and anything they wanted. No, they were a first-class community, the Naga people, and one feels very sorry for them nowadays, the way they've been treated. But they don't really hold it against us to any great extent, the fact that we promised to give them independence. They hold it against the Indian government, who won't give them independence.
How long were you stationed at that camp in Diamapur for?
Oh, well, probably for the first 6 months we were down in that Diamapur in the jungle. It was a rotten area, actually, and it was steaming and wet and humid. But you were glad to get out and up the road to Kohima, which was 5,000 feet up and a lovely, clear atmosphere. And then you would go on. It would take 2 or 3 days to get up to the end of your journey and back down again. And then you would start again and take up again. And we're there until after the monsoon, when they moved us forward up into the Imphal area. And that, as I said earlier, it was about 2,000 feet, a much better and more open area. And then we were moved on into the over the hills where they were building the road to help the engineers in building this road down. So we were down on the Burma side, which was pleasant enough countryside, all jungle though. We cut a road through into Burma and down this Kabul Valley. But when the monsoon came in 1943, we had to pull back into the Imphal plain area because the road wasn't, it was so wet that it would turn into a quagmire when you drove along it. And when we went back again, when the monsoon started in September, October 1943, when it dried up, we went back and the road was completely overgrown, completely covered again. So, it was only admittedly overgrown with creepers and things like that, but bamboo would grow, 20 feet in a season. So, and a very useful piece of equipment it was, a bamboo, because you could use it for anything. You could even eat it, of course, bamboo shoots. It fascinated me to try to get back through this road that was there, and you had literally to cut your way through again. And then in due course that road was metalled with shingle and stones and made quite a useful road. And when we got down into the Burma side, they again cut through, and that was a sandy soil, and this is where the elephants came into use. They would fell the trees and by leaning up against them and knocking them down, and they would pick up the trees and take them and put them down for bridges over streams and things. And then eventually we carried tons and tons of rolls of hessian soaked in bitumen, which was a waterproof type of material, which we rolled out along the roads, the hard, soft, dry surface, and then it would seal that surface, and when eventually the monsoon came, we could still drive over it, so that enabled us to keep going on that road during the monsoon, which in fact helped the Japanese when they were coming back in when they shouldn't have done, because they used that road that we made to come back in with all their guns and equipment and try to get back into India. During that 1943 period, the build-up, the road had been widened, and the build-up and the landing strips had been made on the Imphal plain, so that you could bring in light aircraft at least. And then towards the end of 1943, lengthened still further, and you could bring in Dakotas, which, when the trouble came in 1944, was you couldn't have had a more useful piece of equipment than the Dakota coming in because the road was cut completely. There was no supplies coming in, no contact other than the Dakotas coming in with their supplies and taking out the wounded and anybody that had to go out. And that lasted for three or four months, actually, while the Japanese surrounded the area and tried to dominate the scene. They tried to get the landing strips, but they couldn't. There were landing strips in Assam, where the countryside was flatter, and they could use that as fighter bases, and they would come up and keep the Japanese aircraft away. But initially, the Japanese, they bombed Imphal when the army were coming out, first of all, which again caused confusion, not only amongst the inhabitants of Imphal, because they panicked, but all the cattle and stuff were dead and all lying over the road. The roads were blocked with it, and they would they used their dominance of the air power at that stage, because we didn't have any in when the army came out of Burma. They were, the Japanese took over all the airports in Burma and made good use of them.
Did their domination of the air cause you any problems during that earlier period?
In the earlier days, they would bomb us. And we weren't terribly not like they are now, because but they would bomb you as you had a convoy going along the road with supplies. They would bomb you or try to bomb you with the only thing was you had to make doubly sure that you were well spaced out with your convoy, and it was only on the infall plain where they could bomb, because they couldn't get on the mountain roads. So it's quite a wet area and depleted, you know, a lot of little rivers and bridges over them. So you tried to find a bridge and get underneath the bridge when if you were lucky. But they caused more confusion than chaos, I think. And then as soon as the monsoon came, they couldn't fly either. So and then by the time the monsoon ended, they'd started to get a landing strip, fighter aircraft on the Assam plain, and the Japanese had a much longer strip to go than they did from Assam, and they were soon pushed back and out. So we didn't suffer an awful lot from Japanese air problems after the first 6 or 9 months, I suppose. We were lucky, really, in having a good supply. Well, Air Force fighters, they worked jolly hard, and there were only a few of them, admittedly, but to weave in and out of the mountains, and it wasn't the best of areas to fly in. I mean, Wingate himself was killed in a thunderstorm, and because of this is the sort of thing that happens, you just integrate, and that's that.
What was your rank during the 42-43 period?
Well, I started off second lieutenant. I think after a couple of years, I was made up to lieutenant, and then after about 3 years, captain, and then major for the last 2 or 3 years.
How did your duties change as you progress?
I was up from second lieutenant. I stayed in much the same unit for a lot of the time. Second lieutenant to lieutenant, the same unit. Captain, I was second in command, and all within the same unit. Then when I was made a major, I had a company. I was given a Rajput, an Indian state company. It was Rajputana, which was one of the Indian states, and the Maharaja would come and visit his countrymen from time to time, you know, and cheer them up or try to. But so in the main. And you knew the units that were working with you, and you knew a lot of them, the officers anyway, and so that I suppose there were comparatively few British officers out there, and then as the war went on, they started to bring in. Indian King's Commissioned officers, and gradually they would join you, and by the end of the war, I suppose we were about 50-50, half Indian and half British officers in the units.
And what sort of relationship did you have with your the troops under your command?
Oh, very good. They were very loyal. You tried to do your best for them, and they were. You couldn't have asked for more loyal, faithful people. Actually, as I said earlier on, they never complained, and although they had many, justifications for complaining, many times, they would be theoretically given 1 month's leave a year. But that involved them going back to their villages, which would probably take them at least a week, if not 2 weeks, to get home. It was probably more like 5 or 6 weeks before they got back again. But very, very few of them didn't come back. If they didn't come back, they lost their pay, and that was that. But as they were volunteers, they came back, and they enjoyed their leave away, and they came back in good spirits, usually.
What did you yourself get in the way of leave?
Well, we would get a fortnight a year, it would take you 3 or 4 days to get out from the Assam-Burma area back to Calcutta, was where you would go for, then you would get a fortnight to spend somewhere wherever you wanted to, some would stay in Calcutta. I personally used to go up to the hill stations, Darjeeling and Nainital, Quetta, and on one occasion I went down to, that was later in the war, down to Sri Lanka, or Ceylon as it was then, because a colleague of mine in the unit had a tea planter friend in Sri Lanka, and he said he would put us up, so we catched flights out from that was the time when Lord Louis Mountbatten's headquarters was in Sri Lanka, you see, and SEAC's headquarters. So we were able to catch flights on Dakotas out of Imphal and get down to Sri Lanka. And very nice and pleasant it was, too. So that was our leave, but yes, you made the most of your fortnight's leave. Because you couldn't spend, you'd nothing to spend your money on when you're on active service. There were no shops or anything like that. You had in Imphal a local bazaar with local things that they wanted, but cameras and things like that were just non-existent, and films or anything. So you relied on your rations and made the best of it. Yeah.
Herbert Bryce, Reel 4. How aware were you of the overall situation in Burma and in the rest of the war?
You didn't get a great deal of, certainly in the early stages, you didn't really know what was happening. In the very early stages, when we went up there, you hadn't a clue. You didn't. You knew that Burma was over there somewhere, but you'd no maps. You didn't. There was no. I mean, apart from the world atlases and things like that, and as I said, communications were poor, so you didn't know what was happening. But gradually, as conditions got bigger, more under control, and the army got bigger and bigger, they produced information sheets, and then eventually a little newspaper, which was delivered once or twice a week by aircraft droppings. You know, that was the usual way to deliver them to you. And then they even had a monthly little magazine called SEAC, which was just a little articles of, you know, what this was mainly for the British troops, of course, when and because they were far more likely to grumble than the Indians, Indian troops were, I'm afraid, and admittedly they had a tough wicket to bat along too. But as the war progressed, and information as to what was happening got, you learnt more of it. But but generally speaking, it was several years before we really had any proper sort of information as to what was happening outside.
Were you much aware of the Japanese progress through Burma?
We knew that the Japanese, we knew that they were in Burma,